Hello, and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire & Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. Our subject this month is actress Diane Keaton. Born in 1946, Diane Hall acted and sang in high school and said later that her mother winning a Mrs. Los Angeles pageant for homemakers inspired her to pursue a career in acting. She moved to New York and changed her last name to Keaton and moonlighted in clubs with a singing act. Keaton got a job as an understudy for a Broadway production of Hair and then won the co-lead with Woody Allen for Play It Again, Sam, which earned her a Tony Award nomination. She made her film debut in 1970 in a small role in the comedy Lovers and Other Strangers. After a few roles on TV, she was catapulted into fame by appearing as Kay Adams in The Godfather, a role she described as, quote, a woman in a world of men. After that, Keaton basically never looked back. She teamed with Woody Allen for the 1972 film version of Play It Again, Sam, toggling back and forth between working with Allen and Francis Ford Coppola. She co-starred with the former in 1973's Sleeper, returned as Kay Adams in the latter's The Godfather Part II in 1974, and then went back to Allen for 1975's Love and Death. After a couple of misses, she reteamed with Allen for 1977's Annie Hall, which won numerous Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Director for Allen, and Best Actress for Keaton. Her performance and look in the film became iconic and went on to inspire numerous actresses. She starred in the topical drama Looking for Mr. Goodbar that same year, then back to Allen for Interiors and Manhattan. Keaton then co-starred with Warren Beatty for his war epic Reds, for which he earned another Best Actress nomination. The next year, she co-starred with Albert Finney in the searing divorce drama Shoot the Moon, then led the thriller The Little Drummer Girl. She had massive success in 1987 with the comedy Baby Boom, and that same year directed her first full-length film, the documentary Heaven. She returned as Kay Adams in 1990's The Godfather Part III, and then scored another hit opposite Steve Martin in 1991's Father of the Bride. After reteaming with Allen after many years for 1993's Manhattan Murder Mystery, she co-starred with Bette Midler and Goldie Hawn in 1996's The First Wives Club. She starred and directed 2000's Hanging Up and then reunited with Warren Beatty for the notorious bomb Town and Country. She bounced back in 2003's Something's Gotta Give as a playwright romancing both Jack Nicholson and Keanu Reeves. Keaton continued to work, appearing in the occasional success like 2010's Morning Glory opposite Rachel McAdams and Harrison Ford. But for the most part, she appeared in smaller films as part of an ensemble. She co-starred with Alfre Woodard and Kathy Bates as old friends who reunite in 2024's Summer Camp, which would be her final film. Here with me to discuss Summer Camp and the films of Diane Keaton is University of Tampa film professor Taylor Carey. Hi, Taylor.
Hi, how are you?
I am doing great. I am genuinely honored to have a film professor on my little show. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, whenever someone says that to me of that tone and tenor, I'm always like, curb your enthusiasm, but thank you for having me.
Well, okay, but I'm going to wax your car a little bit more here. I know you're anyway, but the way we got to know each other was for anyone who doesn't know, no one would know this. There's no reason why anyone would know this, but a couple of months ago, the Tampa Theater, a place that I've done a bunch of film intros. We both love that theater very much. They did a screening of Carmen Jones, the Otto Preminger adaptation of the musical, a film that I had never seen, always wanted to see. And I got to finally see it on the big screen. And you did a presentation after the film about its history, about its themes. And as I told you just before we started, it took about 3 minutes into your presentation before I went, I got to ask her to be on Fade Out. That's how that worked.
Yeah, that was so fun. And I loved that lecture. I love Dorothy Dandridge. It was crazy. It was so surreal. I really enjoyed breaking that film down.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Anytime there's a movie that I've been wanting to see for many, many years, and I've just never gotten around to it, and then it pops up and I get to see it for the first time on the big screen, you're like, this movie's 70 years old and I'm seeing it for the first time the way people saw it in 1954, you know, whatever. It's just absolutely perfect. So that was a wonderful afternoon and it led to this. So it's a win-win for everybody here. So Taylor, why did you pick Diane Keaton?
Oh my gosh. I love Diane Keaton so much. I don't even know where to start. I think, you know, I'm familiar with her early work for sure. I think you kind of have to be to a degree. But her early work is foundational. It's awesome, and a lot of it is literally canonical. But the films I fell in love with her in are like First Wives Club, Something's Gotta Give, Because I Said So, and I really loved Book Club, like her later stuff. I think I like the combination of like fierce independence, eccentrism, but then also I self-identify as an ingenue, and I feel like she carved out this space in her career and in her life to be this like lifelong ingenue. And I don't mean to infantilize her or sexualize her in that way. I just mean this lifelong kind of curiosity and softness and warmth. And I think there's this academic term called temporarily able-bodied TAB, and I may be out of date because this is what it was, 10 or 15 years ago. And I remember in college hearing about it and going, that's really weird, or that's really interesting, I should say. And I wrote a paper about it. But what I think is really interesting is like temporarily young. And so I've never put a lot of emphasis and value on my youth in the way that I think society does. And so I've always been very interested in stories that prioritize older women and older women's voices, because that is me, like in the future. And so I think I've always loathed the way Hollywood kind of puts women out to pasture at a certain point, and they're like, okay, you're not interesting. And so the way she just stayed interesting, and she's kind of, I loved the way she carved out a slice and kind of said, I dare you to not have a story for me. I dare you to not have depth for me. And so that's just, I think that's admirable and lovely. And that's how I intend to approach aging interestingly and aging curiously and aging as an ingenue.
One of the things I noticed when doing research for the show is I read about, I mean, I watched a bunch of the movies, but I read about her and I watched a lot of interviews that she did, like contemporary interviews from the 80s and the 90s when she was promoting these various films. And she is, for the most part, like really engaged with these interviews. And that makes her, that it was a really different tenor than what you expect for an actress or an actor who comes out, does some jokes. Can we play the clip? And has a maybe funny story. She's like, I found this clip of her talking to Letterman when she was pushing her documentary, the Heaven documentary, which is by itself an unusual thing, right? Here's Diane Keaton coming out to talk about a documentary. A, that's odd enough. B, that she's not even in, right? She directed it, but she's not even in it. And C, it's about the afterlife. Like, it's all very unusual things. And she is so fully engaged with Letterman that it's incredibly charming. Like, she seems so self-deprecating. She finds the whole, she's giggling because I think she finds the whole thing just kind of silly, and she radiates that. And it just was like, wow, she's fully engaged here. She is not just on autopilot. And I found all that stuff to be really refreshing.
Yeah, I feel like she's like a walking fourth wall break. Like she's like, this is not real. And that kind of, self-effacing, real, authentic, whatever you want to call it, I just think kind of poking fun at the artifice, very self-reflexive and very much like, yes, I'm a legend, but I'm also just Diane, and very present and very grateful for what's unfolding. Grateful to a fault sometimes, I think. Because I watched some of her interviews too, and I remember her talking about like how fortunate she was and how lucky she was, and like you have to have a stroke of luck, and these early directors took a chance on me, and you almost kind of want to be like, well, yeah, but you're Diane Keaton, like forget those guys, like you they gave you a chance, but look what you did with your chance, like this is not just fortune, this is talent, and just so many other things. But yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Watching her interviews is really gnarly because it's like she refuses to kind of even engage in the hubris of like, I am, whatever. And I think that's pretty interesting.
There was a little, like, it's not a story, I guess it's like an aphorism or something that I've heard. And I mentioned it actually just last month on the previous month's episode. We were talking about John Cassavetes, and then we're talking about Jenna Rollins. And it's a quote from, I believe, again, I should look, I keep quoting it, and maybe it's not the right person, but I believe it's Susan Sarandon, who said, Hollywood has three roles for women: hot babe, district attorney, grandma. That's it, right? And Diane Keaton falls in between, and this is the exact same thing I said about Jenna Rollins. We were talking about her, but Diane Keaton really does fall in between all those cracks, because she certainly was a beautiful woman by any stretch of the imagination, but she was never really playing a sex pot in anything in particular. And then I don't think she ever played a district attorney even once. And then she, the couple of movies later on where she plays grandma, I'm like, I don't even, like, apparently there's one movie where she's like Dax Shepard's mom. I'm like, I'm not watching a movie with Diane Keaton sharing screen time with Dax Shepard. I'm just not. I mean, come on. I mean, it's like, here, Picasso, paint this paint by numbers thing that you're doing. Like, what are we doing here? But she managed to carve out this incredible, iconic career. And I have a theory about it, which I might embarrass myself by mentioning it to a film professor, but I'm going to risk it in a moment. But she really did manage to her most iconic roles fall in between all of those poles. And I find that interesting, especially when her career lasted, you know, half a century almost.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, no. Yeah. I think, one of my goals as a woman and as a filmmaker and as a writer, but yeah, as a person, I think is to be timeless. And I think that's a trait I admire so deeply in her, because Janelle Monáe talked about this once on Twitter, like famously, some guy was like, why don't you just wear, you know, a sparkly leotard and dance around? Like, I'm tired of whatever. And she goes, my beauty's not for you. Or it was something like that. And it was just a mic drop moment. Like, and I think Diane Keaton embodies that. Like, I know I'm beautiful. I'll be beautiful my whole life. It's not necessarily for your consumption. And I'm not going to fit into these discrete categories that are purposefully, like, they have an expiration date, by the way, like on purpose. I feel like as women, it's kind of like, I know Endgame, like, I know you want to get rid of me and I'm going to outlast all of these constraints. So I'm beautiful. I'll be beautiful forever, but I'm also quirky. I'm also smart. I'm also interesting. I'm also funny. I'm also soft. I'm also wise. And I think that is so radical as humans, but also as women, like outlasting constraints that, you know, are there. They're just like baked in. And so I think what you said is spot on, especially those three. I can't remember the DA and the
Hot
whatever.
Babe, like, DA, Grandma.
Yeah,
yeah,
it's
those
spot
are the
on.
three. Yeah.
It's spot on. And there's some women who are like, I refuse to play this game.
Mm-hmm. So why, what is your, I mean, you said you came to her a little bit later, kind of her second wave. Because if you look at her career, she, as I mentioned in the intro, she's in The Godfather is her second film. I mean, boom, just rocket ride. And she has a 70s that is just unbelievable and unbelievable. I mean, just even if you never did another film other than Godfather and Annie Hall, you're like, well, that's a career because I'm in two of the most famous. I mean, I would argue if someone said to me, what are the 10 greatest American films ever made? I would put The Godfather and Annie Hall on that list. And that's both of her, two of them in one list is, you know, but you came to her a little bit later, as you said, with like First Wives Club and Something's Gotta Give. Do you remember what, were you aware of who she was when you started discovering her? Or was it just, oh, this is, who's this Diane Keaton person who's in these movies that I'm enjoying? And then you went back and saw the older stuff?
Yeah, totally. Probably a combo. And to answer your question, I have to issue a disclaimer. I must. So if you could humor me, one of the things that's really important to me is respecting your curatorial process. And I talk to my students about it a lot. And so on the first day of class, I'm like, what's your favorite movie? And don't lie to me. And one of my big things as an educator,
don't lie to me.
Don't lie to me. One of my big things as an educator is, you know, I want you to be able to know about what's canonical. I want you to be able to talk about foundational cinema. I want you to be able to talk about it. I want you to be able to talk about D.W. Griffith's Birth of a Nation and talk about these uncomfortable texts, right? But at the same time, no, I do not expect you on a Thursday night to be like, we're whipping up a batch of Margs and we're turning on Birth of a Nation. Like, don't lie. Don't tell me something is your favorite when it, you know, you're just able to discuss it. And I think my students, you know, I think in the film world, you know, I come from UCLA where I got my MFA, and the industry can be a little myopic and a little bit much. And I think in this space, sometimes there's a temptation to just really kind of, oh, my favorite film is Goodfellas and da da da. It's like, it's not. Like, for some people, it really is. But I'm like, don't, when I ask you your favorite film, if it's actually The Little Mermaid, do not say Goodfellas. Like, don't do that, because the people who you look up to, the people who you're, you know, who you want to be like, they chased their whimsy. They chased what, fired them up, and that's how they became legends. And so I always use Steven Spielberg as an example, who I really like. He's a legend, but before he was a legend, he was getting laughed out of rooms trying to pitch dinosaurs. They were like, "Get out of here, you nerd. Like, no one wants to hear about that." And then you fast forward and he has a cinema empire. So what I want to teach my kids is, hey, listen, I love that you love these big guys, 10 IMAX cameras. I love it. And I want you to be able to talk about it. But while you're busy staring up at what that guy built, that's time you could be spending building something of your own. And so don't be ashamed to say, I really am a huge Disney Princess fan, or I really am a huge whatever. These are the films that light me up. I can talk to you about this film, but man, I really light up when I think about this or when I watch this. Don't forget to do that. And so that's my disclaimer. And I say that to say I fiercely like cling to my curatorial process, and you have to kind of get rid of the shame of all that. So I am coastal grandma core, like to the like to my core. Like I bleed coastal grandmother. And I think when I met Diane, it was probably Something's Gotta Give. And I think it would have been like around the time it came out. And I would have probably been like a pre, you know what? Let me not date myself. Doesn't matter how old I was. But I know, I believe I was with my mom, and my mom was hyping this lady up. My mom was like, "That's Diane Keaton. I love her." And I was like, "Really?" And that's kind of where it goes. And then, of course, as a film, a budding, cinephile, and film lover, then I go back and I'm like, "Well, who is this woman in the world of, film? Who is this woman?" But it's a little bit topsy-turvy because I watched The Godfather, don't call CPS. I watched The Godfather like before I watched Something's Gotta Give. I think I watched The Godfather for the first time when I was like 10, which is illegal. Like, I don't know who allowed that. And I remember hating it, obviously. I was like, this is really high octane, my cortisol. This is a lot. I'm not enjoying myself. I didn't like it. But I remember seeing her, and I remember her performance being really intense and visceral and wonderful. But it wasn't where I fell in love with her. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Yeah. So I think that's where I fell in love with her. And my friends and I still quote that. My friends and I still say, "Don't you ever wonder why I married your father? He was the only man I ever saw." It's just a very quotable film. And watching her kind of, again, giving women the space to discover who they are, irrespective of mom, even though mom is an amazing title, and irrespective of wife, even though that's also a lovely title. She's at this age where it's kind of like, who are you and what are you doing in the film? And she's just chasing whimsy and discovers so many layers of herself. And I think even as a teenager, that resonated with me. And I probably have always felt a little temporarily young. My mom was older. She had me when she was older, and I'm the youngest. And so I guess I've just always been a coastal grandma on the inside. So when I saw it, I was like, this film's about me. Nancy Myers got it right. Like, I don't know why I just identified with the whole thing, but that's where I met her, I think.
I found it very interesting that during the last 25 to 30 years of her, really the last 25, like basically all the stuff of the in this century, and a little bit before that, when her career starts to thin out a little bit in terms of the leading role she's getting and the quality of the role she's getting, all of, for the most part, all of the big successes post her initial decade of absolute white hot heat came from women. Baby Boom or Something's Gotta Give, or when she does, they all, and I'm like, that can't be a coincidence that men at a certain point just did not know what to do with her. And so it took Nancy Myers to be like, no, Diane Keaton, what are we talking about here? Diane Keaton, you know? And so it's like, okay, that tells you. And because there were so few women directors and writers, Diane Keaton just doesn't get as many opportunities as you would expect because she's Diane friggin' Keaton.
Yeah, that's such a good point. I never charted that with that line of demarcation, but you are absolutely right. And that's such a good point. Oh gosh, I forgot my point because I was so busy complimenting you. I don't remember what
All right.
I was gonna
So, all right. So while I'm ahead, I'm now going to risk making a total jackass of myself, but it's my show. It's okay. Whatever. Right? Right?
Oh
Okay.
God.
Because nobody's listening. So anyway, as I was watching her films and going through all the ones in the 70s that I had never seen before, I will for now, and Harry and Walter Go to New York and stuff like that. But I tried to figure out Because she wasn't just popular. And the reason I want to bring it up now is because you mentioned your mom. Your mom was saying to you, you got to check this woman out. I love Diane Keaton. You got to check this out. So Diane Keaton wasn't just popular in the 70s. She was iconic. She was, and it wasn't just the clothes in Annie Hall that became very fashion forward. And she dressed in a way that suggested a grander scope of how women could dress in movies. I mean, she's wearing a tie and she's wearing kind of baggy clothes and vet. Like, it's not just, it's kind of like what you were saying about, it's not, I'm trying to appeal to the male gaze. It's, I want to dress this way because I think I look good. Right. So anyway, I'm kind of wondering, how did she transcend from the merely popular into something iconic? How does that happen? How does that person cross, like, and this is not in any way any sort of knock on these actresses, but it's sort of like at the time, like you've got, who are her contemporaries in the 70s, right? You've got like a Shelley Duvall or say a Sissy Spacek or maybe Jane Fonda. Fonda maybe, but like they aren't, these other ones are not iconic the way Keaton was. And I'm like, well, what is it? So this is my theory. And again, I may, by saying this to a film professor, I may really be dooming myself,
Oh my gosh,
but
no.
okay. This is my unified field theory of Diane Keaton, is her two biggest films, The Godfather and Annie Hall, right? They are as popular and as culturally impactful as you possibly could ask for in the 1970s, outside of being in like Star Wars or something, right? In Annie Hall, she is playing the absolute, she's playing the woman of the 1970s, right? The most hip, now, post, first wave feminism version of women, right? That's Annie Hall. In all of her, in all of women's, in every respect, in that, like, she's goofy, she's funny, she's smart, she's melancholy, she's got everything, right? So she is the absolute version of 1970s womanhood in Annie Hall. In The Godfather, she is then playing, or obviously that was before Annie Hall, but in The Godfather, she is playing the ultimate example of the kind of woman that women of the 70s were rejecting, which was the put upon housewife, right? That had no rights, that had absolutely no control over that, no agency, no nothing. Everything had to go through their domineering husbands. And I have to wonder, if you're a woman in the 70s and you're looking at this and you say, well, Diane Keaton is encompassing everything. She's encompassing what women to me are now and what they used to be and what we're rejecting, what feminism is rejecting. I don't know if that makes any sense whatsoever, but I wanted to share it with you.
Oh my God, no, it makes perfect sense. And I mean, for the record, I don't know if I'm going to make any sense. So we may both be speaking in wingdings. I think what you said made sense. What I'm about to say may not make sense. I think, let's be honest, when you met me, I was lecturing about Otto Preminger's leery male gaze and Carmen. So I'm, I am, there's a fire inside me for sure. I think when I've, oh, they're gonna crucify me. They are literally gonna nail me to a cross, and that's not gonna be pleasant. I'm not looking forward to it. When I first saw Annie Hall, I was a little underwhelmed, I'm gonna be honest. But I understand that part of the reason that that was the case is because you're looking at time. And I talked to my kids about this too. If you watch, for example, let's bring back D.W. Griffith. If you watch Birth of a Nation and then you go, and that's like an action film, right? And we're supposed to be excited and we're kind of using coverage for the first time. And there's like all these different sizes and angles. If you watch that and it's supposed to be elliptical and scary, and then you watch Jurassic World, you're gonna kind of be like, wow, that first movie was a snooze fest. I wasn't worried at all. And that's because of the evolving, taste and technique and what we're used to and all of that, right? So when I saw it, I didn't see it in time and space. I didn't see it where it was built. And so I was kind of like, okay, I get it. We've got some witticisms. Also, When Harry Met Sally is my favorite film, so I was already spoiled by that. Like I'd already, and so I know that's a predecessor, that's an ancestor, and I get it. I would argue that In both of those films, her character's kind of in service to the man who the story is like about. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
So she's like eccentric and interesting for Woody Allen. And he's like, wow. Like you can tell he's kind of like analyzing her. And quite literally, like I mentioned the fourth wall earlier, like literally. Directorially, but also like in the film, he's like fascinated by her. And then with The Godfather, yes, she's like this ethical mirror. You know, it was an abortion. She's this ethical mirror, being like, you're wrong. And this is, you know, this is wrong. And so there's nothing wrong with that. I am not saying both of those films should go in the trash can because I do believe, you know, The Godfather especially is canonical. I'm not arguing both of those films should go in the trash can at all. I don't think, you know, that's not what I'm saying, but I think. When you ask the question, why she's such an icon, especially for women, I think it's because she played this really delicate long game, and maybe consciously, maybe not, of being timeless. And so she's playing these characters, and she's got this eccentricism, and she's got this dynamism, and she's got this range. But then again, like we said in the beginning, she never banked on the male gaze. And as you kind of so articulately put it, the male gaze does and will abandon you. So at a certain point, these, you know, at a certain point, it's like, well, what do we do with you now? And women have the answer because she was consistently herself. And when you have a career that spans that many decades, people are bound to meet you at different times. So I met her at Something's Gotta Give, but a lot of cinephiles met her at Annie Hall, and everyone fell in love for different reasons. Do you know what I mean? So I feel like there's no harm, no foul. But I don't know.
Yeah, no,
I felt your spirit drop a little when I said I was
no,
underwhelmed
no, 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 no,
when
no,
I
no.
saw.
That it's all
Okay,
come,
good.
you know, I mean, I look, I, you know, regardless of how I feel about Woody Hall, Woody Allen now, and you know, whatever, I still regard Annie Hall as like just one of the great movies ever made, because again, yes, it is. I mean, all Woody Allen movies are about Woody Allen. He can't help himself. But I find that,
God, he can't help himself is now there's so much dimension to that statement.
it's,
Oh
you know, yeah, that's a
my
loaded phrase, but it's, there was something about her in that movie where she gets to, I felt like she got to be everything that a person gets to be, right? She is, I mean, she, you could argue she is like the early version of the manic pixie dream girl kind of
Yeah.
thing, but she, you know, they don't end up together. You know what I mean? Like he ruins it and he gives it, you know, and so it's like she just she gets to play so many different dimensions. And this is something that I think in her later films, especially in some of the ones that, again, of like the last quarter century, I feel like other filmmakers see Annie Hall and are inspired by it, and they just kind of gave her goofy stuff to do without the wit part of it. Like she just got to be, and like there was a point where like there's a lot of films where she's like in her 60s and she's sort of like screaming and yelling and kind of acting very childish, and I'm like, she should be, you should be giving her something a little more meaty to do again, because you're Diane Keaton. And like you were talking about, with Something's Got to Give, it takes Nancy Myers to give her a rounded part, you know, all the different dimensions that she can play. And that's, you know, it's like, yeah, that's because that's something worthy of her talent.
Yeah, and I think, you know, going back to curatorial process with, and if you notice in my analysis, I didn't mention Woody Allen and the allegations and all of that. Just the film itself I found underwhelming. But what I want my students to learn and what I think is perfectly, you know, kosher is being able to put a film in place and say, you know, this film, this these films that I love wouldn't be here if it weren't for this film. I didn't care for it. And I think, you know, all in part, I mentioned When Harry Met Sally just because I do think you could, in some way, squint and put those two films in conversation with one another.
Oh, sure.
I personally feel like what Woody Allen was doing, I think Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron came along and perfected it. And, you know, I'll just say this because we're kind of dancing around the thing and we don't need to focus on it, but I will say, as much as I love Diane, it causes me such cognitive dissonance. And I've never been able to really find a place for it. She is such an icon to me as a woman. I've always felt queasy about the fact that the whole time, for her whole life, she said, you know, hey, I believe my friend, and really vouched for Woody. And I've never really understood that. And it's just so painful and strange, but that I just felt like the need to say that just so I'm not, as a woman, dancing around that and laughing and being like, yeah, well, anyway, I don't want to anyway it, but we don't have to belabor the point.
Right.
I was separating art from artists, but I mean, to focus on the artist for a few minutes, like, yeah, into the bin. I try to say that, to
I
my opinion, into the trash can, but we don't have to
no,
sit
I hear.
there.
I remember at the time after all that, that initial stuff broke with him and the stuff with Mia Farrow, and then Diane sort of swooped back in and became his leading lady again for like Manhattan Murder Mystery. And I remember thinking, huh, that's a
It's
conscious
puzzling.
choice. She's throwing him a sort of life preserver by coming back to be in his movies. And I thought, that's a choice. That's a choice. So well, I watched a bunch of her movies that I had never seen before, and we don't have to go through them in order or anything like that. Let's just pick one. What is one of the ones that you would want to just talk about? Maybe something that you saw in prep for this, or you've just always loved, and it's maybe one of the more famous ones. What is one of her filmography that you would want to talk about?
I also fell madly in love with her in The First Wives Club. And that's also the most quotable movie in the world, in my circles, in my small feminized circle. And I think just that therapy session scene, is that Marcia Gay? Is that who that is? Let me
I don't
double
remember,
check.
yeah.
Marcia, let me double check so I don't sound like a moron. Yeah, I think it is. Yep, Marcia Gay Harden
There
is
you go.
the therapist who's just so slimy. And her ex-husband comes in and she's beating him with the pool noodle and she's trying to resurrect the marriage. And I just remember this scene where she's screaming like, "And I'm sorry for loving you." I just watching her go from, wife who's under his feet to someone triumphantly trying to find herself is so fun. Watching her play with Bette Midler is so fun. It's just fun.
I mean, it's great watching the three of them, which are all the three of those three
Goldie
actors.
Hawn. Yeah, yeah,
Yeah,
yeah.
Goldie Hawn and Bette Midler, and they're all playing at that level. It is fun. I'll tell you, it's funny. I have a little personal story I have from that film because I won't get into the names because I know they're not listening, but nevertheless, I had a friend back at the time who was married, and him and I were friends, and I was friends with his wife as well. And she always said I was like her favorite of her husband's friends. And she wanted to see First Wives Club, and I wanted to see First Wives Club. And her husband had no interest in First Wives Club, none.
Why?
He right? He just was not in the mode to see that kind of movie. So I said, "Well, I'll just go with her. We'll go together." And
I love it.
he was like, "No." I'm like, what do you mean no? And he's like, that's just not appropriate. And I'm like, what do you mean it's not appropriate? And he could not, really get comfortable with the idea of me and his wife going out to see a movie, even though, and I used to say to him, well, I'm like, and then of course we were in kind of a relationship where we would really, as dudes tend to do, really dig at one another. When you find a weak spot, you just shove the knife in because then you're kind of like, I would say to him, and I don't want to slip and accidentally say his name, but I used to say to him, well, let's examine this a little bit. So what you're saying is you don't either trust your wife or you don't trust me. Those are both
Sir.
bad things. And he was like, no, that's not what I'm saying. I'm like, well, it is what you're saying because she wants to see the movie. I want to see the movie. We don't want to go by ourselves. Why not? And he just was like, no, it's just not appropriate. And it's,
Basically,
there's, you know,
staunchly against First Wives Club. Like, he really has,
He
he's
just, some
not about
people,
it.
some people just cannot fathom the idea of seeing a movie they don't want to see. Like that to them is death. And for me, I'm always like, it's just a movie. Like how bad could it be? You know what I mean? I've
Well,
gone
we
to
should
lots of
send him.
movies that I don't want to see because I'm like, this person wants to see it. I'll go see it. It's
Send
90
him
minutes. Like
a
what?
box set like it's a horse head. Like, make him wake up with a DVD of First Wives Club. He's gonna be like, "Oh my God!" Like, and be like, "Yeah, here you go."
Yeah. I mean, they're no longer married, so make of that what you will. So the First Wives Club, obviously, and a big hit for her, right? It was like a big, like it really was like she's back, she's famous again, like Diane Keaton is back. Okay. You know, I'm like it really
It
was
was
like
a
her,
perfect vehicle for a resurrection, like the perfect vehicle.
So okay, one of the ones I want to mention is, and this is a film that I will, okay, let me just Shoot the Moon from 1982. Have you seen this?
Oh, I don't think I've seen it.
Okay,
Sorry.
so this is, I mentioned it in the intro. This is a divorce drama with Albert Finney and Diane Keaton as a couple that are getting a divorce. Their marriage is falling apart. Albert Finney, in the movie, surprise, surprise, is a raving drunk
Oh,
and
God.
abusive, and he's abusive to his wife and abusive to his children. And he then takes up with a younger woman played by Karen Allen, who I always love. And then Diane Keaton takes up with the local handyman who is installing a tennis court at their house, played by a very young and very handsome Peter Weller.
Oh, my goodness.
And it is, look, I can't in good conscience recommend people see it because it is tough going. It is
Oh,
a tough,
man.
tough watch because they do not round the edges of this film at all. It is brutal to watch about this, the way this couple falls apart. But I found it absolutely amazingly compelling, and Keaton is fantastic in it.
Oh,
And it's so it's a movie that, like I said, I can't recommend really for anyone other than a real diehard cineast because it's not a fun time. It's not a fun time at the movies, but it is really good.
I'm okay with not a fun time. I will definitely watch it. I'm perfectly fine with not a fun time. That's
Okay.
crazy.
Yeah.
Oh, I'll definitely watch it.
I mean,
Okay.
it's grueling. It's a grueling movie, but it's like, because Albert Finney is
Oh,
just such a, he's such a terrible, terrible person in this movie. But she is, I mean, she is there with him. She is there going toe to toe with his volcanic energy. And of course, you know, as is typical with a lot of films where, you know, someone of Diane Keaton's caliber is sort of paired with the big male star, the male star gets to be big, right? And
that's what I'm
like, you know, and
saying.
she has to be quiet and kind of
That's what
reflective.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Her early work, it's like the, and I don't want to generalize, you know. I'm already probably scheduled to get crucified after I
Oh.
said what I said about Woody Allen. So I don't want to generalize, but man, I feel like the films I like the best are where she's navigating her life as like the main character, or navigating motherhood, or navigating her sexuality, something that's like immediate to her. And I think my least favorite are the films where she's playing a supporting role to a love interest whose story it actually is, or where she's like, you know, as women are often cast as like a mirror, like an ethical mirror, like, you know, some kind of virtue signaling, you know, beacon. So I'm always like, but I don't know. At the same time, where you meet her is where you meet her. And I will say, Lovers and Other Strangers, which I saw a long time ago, and so I don't remember a lot of it, but it, I remember it being really damn good. I liked it. I thought it was very witty.
She's funny in that. She only has like about two, three scenes.
I know.
But she's pretty funny in it. I remembered why I watched it on YouTube and I was like, the minute I'm watching it and it was like a half hour in, and I'm like, when is she showing up? And then she sort of shows up in this wedding scene and I'm like, oh, there she, you know? And it's just funny to see someone who doesn't yet have the radiance of a movie star because she's not a movie star yet. But you're like, well,
Yeah.
there's Diane damn Keaton just sitting there at this wedding table having this one or two scenes and stuff. So, yeah, again, what a rocket
Yeah.
ride she was about to go on. And she was like one film and then boom, second film, Godfather. Like, oh my God. Like, how could you even get ready for something like that? So, okay. Well, in response to what you just said about her having more agency, right? Another film I want to mention is this 1984 drama she did, Mrs. Soulful. Have you seen this one?
God, you're really catching me, and I'm so
Okay.
embarrassed. It brought me on to ruin my
Okay.
reputation.
That's
Like,
what I'm here
that's
for.
literally.
I love dragging my guests on. That's always a great idea as a podcast host. But the reason I'm mentioning Mrs.
Oh,
Soulful,
no, I have seen this. I have seen this. It was a long time ago.
She met a very young Mel Gibson, is a prisoner. He's got a brother, Matthew Modine, and they are bank robbers, and they are in the jail run by Diane Keaton's husband, played by Edward Herrmann. And she is clearly unsatisfied, dissatisfied with her life with Edward Herrmann because he's kind of a bit of a stiff and he's sort of emotionally unavailable. And it's set in like the 1910s. So, of course, you know, he regards her as just, well, take care of the kids. That's your job to do. So she meets Mel Gibson, who, of course, again, another problematic person, but
I
in
remember.
1984, he was pretty damn handsome and pretty damn charming. And she falls for him, and she, and it's based on a true story, and she is willing to rip up her entire life to A, help him escape jail and run off with him, when knowing that that would be, not only is it illegal, it is just completely unacceptable by modern American society. But even though she's playing off against Mel Gibson, she is the driver of that movie. She's the one making all the decisions to do this, right? To rip up her comfortable, if boring, life to run away with this man that obviously sent some sort of charge through her. And I actually thought that was a pretty, and get directed by a woman, by the way. Again, coincidence, question mark. I actually thought that was, I actually thought it was a really pretty good movie. And there's this moment in the film where she's talking to Mel Gibson through the bars, and because she's coming over and she's reading him Bible verses, and that's the excuse she gets to visit him. And she sticks a file, I think, in her boot. She sticks something in her boot as contraband. And while she's reading the Bible, he has to run, he has to like run his hand down her like calf to grab this thing.
I
And
saw
she,
this a long time ago. I feel like it was like HBO in a hotel, and
yeah,
I
oh, it played,
not
yeah.
old enough.
And she lets loose this little giggle of like, it's passion. It's not, it's like this very girlish kind of like, she's obviously feeling this electric charge. Partly because the man is touching her, but partly because she's doing this transgressive thing. And I watched that and I was like, that's not something that's in the script. That's something she did either in the moment or thought about and did it because it felt so utterly real to me, of like, she's now all in on this journey, even though it's probably going to ruin her life.
100%. I remember thinking, wow, what a curly bangs, like badass. I do remember. I was like, okay, bangs, like let's do this. And I love a period piece. But no, I think that improvisational charm is something I really love about her. And you hear her utter these asides or just have these moments of very clear demonstrative like pleasure or disgust, or we talk about when directing actors like micro movements and the way that they just do something with their facial expression that's like bam, and the leap from stage to screen is so intense, and on stage that doesn't cut it, and on screen you've gotta this is the frame, this is what we're working with. Now show me rage, now show me lust, now show me heartbreak, right? And so the most skilled are able to do that. And I just genuinely think she's such a skilled actor. And that is what gives you, I think, timelessness. It's not, I don't want to sound like a jerk, but skating by on your looks, or you're to be looked in this, I should say, or skating by on a some kind of gimmick or skating by. I think she came out of the gate with something that can last you from your 20s to your 90s, which is skill.
Yeah. There's a one other, I don't want to keep going on
If
about
you
Mrs.
name the
Saufel.
film that I don't remember, I'm literally gonna throw my laptop.
No. There's just one other scene in Mrs. Saufel that I just want to mention. Again, I want to keep going on and on about it, but there's a scene where like she's mulling over whether to really go all the way with this, right? She's kind of, because she's got kids and she does love her husband. And there's this great moment at the dinner table with Edward Herrmann where she's kind of very shortly going to decide, is she really going to do this? And she turns to her husband and basically says something to the effect of, because he's the warden of this prison. She says something to the effect of, let's go away. You've been working so hard. Let's go away. Let's take a vacation. Let's take a trip. Just the two of us without the kids. And she's clearly, without saying it, she's tr clearly trying to say to her husband, give me something to latch onto so I don't go down this road. And he doesn't see that, and he just ignores her basically, because he's like, well, I have a lot of work to do here at the prison. And you see it register on her face that she's given this guy one last chance to reconnect with her, and he has passed up on it. And then it's almost like, all right, well, now I'm going to go do this other thing. And it's really heartbreaking because she's trying. She's trying, and it's all on her face. It's not in the screen. She's not saying what she's really meaning, but yet you know that that's what she's trying to convey. So I say again, the movie is not a great, it's not like a lost masterpiece or anything, but she
Sure.
is the driver of it, and I thought she was really terrific in it.
So, but what you mentioned about the facial stuff, and I mean, 100%. And I think going back to something's gotta give, I think it's like it's actually a gift now. And I send it to my friends quite often, but that when we're panning towards her and she's typing to Jack Nicholson and she's like heartbroken, there's this moment where she's like typing and she's crying. Or is she, I don't remember if she's typing to him or if she's writing her script. I can't remember the context in the film,
Might have
but
been
she's
she's writing the
typing.
play, right? She's writing, working on the
I
play
think
that she
so. I
wrote.
don't remember, but she's typing and she just starts crying like while she's working and she has this tissue and she just kind of looks to the side and it keeps working. And it's just such a memorable like moment. And it's just, I don't know, it lives on like recontextualized or void of context even. And you literally, I'll send you that gif before, the week is out. You literally can use it for any context. And I just, I'm sure the script says like, she's sobbing. I'm sure the script just says like something and Diane's like, I'll give you sobbing. It's just unforgettable.
No offense to the legendary, beyond legendary Jack Nicholson, but is there any woman that would pick Jack Nicholson over 30-ish Keanu Reeves in that
I
movie?
believe it. And I remember watching that with an ex. So just like the guy who said, I'm not taking my wife to see First Wives Club, I remember trying to get an ex of mine into the Diane Keaton cult. And I turned on Something's Gotta Give for him and he was done with the scene where Jack Nicholson is in the kitchen and he's in the robe and he's like, hey ladies, like, and my ex was like, are we joking? Like there's nothing appealing about this man. Like, how is he the love interest? And I'm like, just hang on. But yeah, no, when juxtaposed with Keanu Reeves, the 40-something doctor,
As a doctor, right?
it doesn't, and he's like perfect and he has his little glasses and he's like, I'd love to take you to Paris. Like, I'm great. Like, you had me at glasses and doctor in Paris. Like, I don't know. I don't know about that. I don't know.
Yeah, even I mean, I love Jack Nicholson, but I'm watching it. I'm like, oh, come on, you know? I mean, come on. Well,
Yeah.
you know, Keanu Reeves at like the height of his beauty, and he's a
No,
doctor, and he's
gorgeous. Yeah,
sweet, and he loves her plays. So it's like he's cultured. It's like, yeah, Nancy Meyer really stacking the deck, you know, there. But then, you know, men directors do that all the time in their movies. So what the hell? So okay, what's another one of Diane Keaton's movies that you would want to talk about?
I love her as a standalone woman. I love her as a mom. I feel like in The Other Sister and in The Family Stone, she's such a compelling mom, especially The Other Sister. I feel like she does a good job of being a mom with a challenge.
To
And so
say the
that,
least, in that one.
yeah. She's good as a mom with a problem to solve or a, something. I shouldn't say a problem to solve, but like something to work with. And so I think that's really charming. Let's see. And I mentioned Lovers and Other Strangers just so I wouldn't sound like such a killjoy. Like, men in the 70s were bad. Like, now we're in the 2020s and I like it. But, I just want to circle back to that to say I don't think any talents were wasted in that film. I thought it was really witty. So I just want to put that out there. So maybe they delay my crucifixion. Maybe
All
it'll
right, and
be, like,
with a
yeah,
couple
next.
of weeks.
But no, I loved her in The Other Sister. I loved her in The Family Stone. I mean, we can talk about Father of the Bride. I think it's fun. I think it's witty. I don't know that I would like fire it up and be like, I really want to watch this weekend, but I think it is witty and fun for sure.
I do want to talk about The Other Sister because I did watch that one.
Ooh.
That's kind of a movie that's sort of just gone down the memory hole because people don't remember it.
Yeah.
And it, for people who haven't seen it, which is most people, Diane Keaton and Tom Skerritt are the parents of three daughters, one of which played is a woman played by Juliette Lewis, who is mentally challenged. And she has gone to live in sort of a, some sort of school, like a kind of, you know, a boarding school, not boarding school, but you know what I mean? Like a place to help people who have challenges like that. And then they pick her up, they bring her home, and they're having to adjust to the idea that she is a grown woman and she wants to have her own freedom, even though they're, of course, very concerned that she is not capable of leading her own life. And then she meets another a young man who is also mentally challenged, played by Giovanni Ribisi. It's the kind of movie that they just would not make today because you would just not cast actors to play those parts, non-mentally challenged actors to play those parts. You just wouldn't do it. And it's funny, I was looking at reviews of that movie online and like on Letterboxd, and some people just revile it. I mean, just give it like a half star, saying this is offensive trash. And I didn't get that vibe from it. I didn't get the sense that it was exploitative. It was a little clumsy. It's directed by Gary Marshall, not the most subtle, of directors. But I thought it had its heart in the right place. And Diane Keaton is given a difficult part to play because she is kind of the only one in the family who is like, my daughter is not ready for this, and I'm trying to protect her. And it makes her unlikable in some respects. And I felt bad for Diane Keaton for playing the part, but I also gave her credit for like taking it on because it's a tough part to play.
It's tough, and the heartbreak is palpable, the fear is palpable. I feel like Sarah Paulson and Juliette Lewis, Giovanni Ribisi, I think they're all very relieved that a lot of people aren't talking about this film and don't
Yeah,
remember it,
it's a
because
forgotten movie. Yeah.
I think the ethics are wild, and you're right. In this day and age, I think the major complaint is probably why is an actor without an exceptionality playing a character with an exceptionality, and did anybody with mental health exceptionalities have authorship? And you heard me harping about authorship at the lecture for Carmen, right? Did anybody from this community help write the script? Did anybody from this community direct? And so those are like clear, valid flaws. I've got to point them out, but it's on my list for a reason. And it's on your list for a reason. I think the performances are great, especially Diane. And I think it's like there's a lot to work with there. Heartbreak, grief, and then of course you've got like the catharsis at the end. So I don't know. And the last time I saw it, I was really young, but I remember it sticking with me for multiple reasons, some more personal than others. But it stuck with me. And I mean, there's just a lot that happens to a family when you have to navigate that kind of stuff. And I think Diane does a really good job of selling that,
Completely, completely. Again, when she decides not to go to her daughter's wedding, and in sort of protest, it was like, oof, that like, I could almost imagine like if she's reading the script, going, "Do I go this far? Because people are gonna hate me for not doing that." And it's in there. It's in. Now she eventually, relents, but initially, it's like that's tough going, and. Contrary to what I was saying earlier about, the whole like hot babe district attorney grandma thing, like that's a part very few actors could really take on successfully, is that tricky a character to where you really don't like them for their actions, because of course you're on Juliette Lewis's side. Of course you are, because she's this young woman struggling to lead her own life. And here's Diane Keaton constantly sort of saying, no, you can't, you can't, you can't. It makes you not like her, but at the same time, it's like, well, you do understand she's just trying to protect her child from the cruel world out there.
And I think any actor who has to play a character with antagonistic properties, even if they're not like a full-on villain, I think they'll tell you that person, I have to believe that what I'm doing is right. Like even Thanos has to believe that what he's doing is right. Like
Thanos was right.
we need the snap. Like he has to believe it. And that's the trick. And I think she does a good job of embodying, because a lesser skilled actor might have played it differently, and it might have been kind of ham-fisted or, cruel, like you said, or ableist. And I think she has this like vulnerability and again like fear, heartbreak, hope, and you can see the tenderness and like the need to protect, and you feel her stress like through the screen. And I just think that's not easy.
No, not at all. So okay, one I'm going to mention that is an absolute disaster, and not her fault, but an absolute disaster is when she reunites with Warren Beatty for Town and Country.
Oh,
This was a
Lordy.
not this was an like a mega bomb because it was this movie that like, I mean, it's just a romantic comedy. That's it. It's not anything. It's not the, it's not Avengers Endgame, but this thing ended up costing over $100 million because they had to rewrite parts of it, and then
Oh,
they had to
no.
reshoot, and they had to go back, and like it ended up shooting over 2 years. I mean, it's just one of these boondoggles that now, generally, it's not my money, so what do I care? I'm just judging the film for what it is. But it came front loaded, knowing, oh my God, this thing was a notorious disaster. But I'm like, you know what? I form my own opinions. Let me watch this.
You sit there confident with your popcorn, like, I'm a free man. Like,
I'm a free
I'll
man. I do what I want. Nobody's gonna tell me
watch
if nobody's gonna tell me to dislike Town and Country if it's good.
if
I'm here to
you
tell you it's a disaster
want. Oh,
creatively
man,
as
tell me
well.
about
It
it.
is
Tell me about it.
horrendously unfunny. It is juvenile humor, and
Oh,
it's the fact
no.
that it's got Warren Beatty and Diane Keaton and Goldie Hawn again. It's partly written by Buck Henry, the legendary Buck Henry. Gary
And
Shandling is in this. It is full
Warren
of
Beatty,
Kassia Kinski, full of great people, and it is. I said this on my Blue Sky account. I think it might be the single worst big budget Hollywood movie I've ever seen. Like,
Oh,
there's other movies that have no budget and are played Z grade actors, and I mean that I'm not counting that those movies. I'm talking about something with studio resources. There is not a single laugh to be had in
oh.
Town and Country. Not a single one. And it's beneath them all. Like, it's just juvenile. And you're like, everyone here is like 60. What are we doing in this? It is horrendous. And I got mad on Diane Keaton's behalf that she's stuck in this piece of garbage. I'm like, Warren Beatty apparently took over and ran roughshod over the director and decided to shoot it his own way, and they blah 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 blah. But poor Diane Keaton is just there to show, just there to play this part. But I'm like, oh, this is, oh, what? It's so bad.
First of all, you know what my plans are for this evening.
Oh
So
boy.
if you're
Oh.
I will be watching that. And secondly, I fell in love with Warren Beatty in Splendor in the Grass. Is it Splendor in the Grass or Splendor of It's In? I fell in love with him with that film. So this is tough to hear. But I mean, I believe it. And that's always such a horror story when you hear, like, oh, that was 2001? Whoa.
Oh,
That's such a horror story.
and it's when you think about that their other film together was Reds, which I think is an absolute masterpiece. I love Reds. It
Yeah.
is a trem is one of the great Hollywood epics. And it's another thing where Diane Keaton is in this love triangle between Warren Beatty and Jack Nicholson, and they're both completely besotted by her, which you completely buy because
Yeah.
she's fantastic in that movie. And then you're like, boy, they did this. They came back together for this. What the hell? And again, I was angry on Diane Keaton's behalf. So, okay. Now, you mentioned earlier that the book club, there's two of them, there's two book club movies. That was something that really popped for you. I have not seen those. So what's so special about the book club movies?
Now, the second one I didn't absolutely emphatically love, and I, you
Okay.
know, that's okay. The first one, oh, it's just charming. It's fun. It's like, it's just something you throw on, pour a glass of wine and
Right.
throw on your, you know, whatever, your throw blanket, and you just sit there. I, again, going back to how I feel, I just love stories that, talk about women's lives like after 40 or after 45. I feel like everyone acts like there's this precipice and there's this cliff and then we all just die. Like it's like you got married, that was fine for a little, and now we don't hear from you. And so I just like stories where we're prioritizing like the after or the in between or the idea that there's after to be had. You know what I mean? And so it's just charming. It's just charming, and it's fun to see these older women like laughing and talking about, oh my God, I have to find that scene. Oh my goodness, I have to find that scene and I'll email it to you.
Who else is in those? Is it Mary Steenburgen and Jane
It's big
Fonda?
names. Yeah, I think it is. It's Jane Fonda, Candace Bergen,
Candace Bergen,
and
that's the
Mary
other one.
Steenburgen.
Candace
Yeah, and
Bergen.
Candace Bergen is so funny in this. And she and, oh God, is it Wallace Shawn?
Wallace
Wallace
Shawn is in Book Club.
Shawn, like 17 in the car. And it's like, having fun, being promiscuous, being navigating marriage, navigating health scares. Jane Fonda still having like commitment issues with Don Johnson, who I really love him, and I should probably bring that up in therapy. Why do I have such an affinity for Don Johnson? It's not age appropriate, but Jane Fonda and Don Johnson, that dynamic is so fun and so flirty. And then Andy Garcia is just
Oh my
so.
God, Andy Garcia is in. Oh my, my wife
It's
will want to watch
so
it now.
fun. No, it's so fun. And I think if I remember correctly, I saw it for the first time maybe 5 or 6 years ago. If I remember, I think I saw it in theaters with one of my girlfriends, like, and I think there was wine, and we were like, hee. Very on brand evening. We were like, let's go. I think if I remember correctly, one of the subplots was like Diane Keaton's daughters kept like hovering and being helicopter daughters, and they were like, "Mom, you have to move in with us and like move into the basement." And so this whole theme of like being, once you're older, you lose this level of agency. And I love the way Diane kind of plays that, and I love the way that story was prioritized. Getting older or turning a certain age doesn't mean I automatically lose my agency. It doesn't mean I'm automatically less interesting. It doesn't mean I lose my wanderlust. And going back to what I said at top, it doesn't mean I lose my curiosity. And so she has this like career spanning curiosity and whimsy. And I think, especially with, I think with human beings for sure, but I think with women, I think there's like a cap. It's like, okay, we'll just grow up and get married and shut up. And I think, not that that's marriage means shutting up. I sound so skeptical, but I think just chasing your whimsy until the end and being like, no, I'm going to do what excites me and what lights me up. And just because I'm turning this age doesn't mean I have to stop. So I'm rambling.
No, 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 no. I said I those that I mean, God, it spawned a sequel. I'm like, God, it was successful enough, but I just did not see it. But I mean, I'm glad that it worked for you. That's great. I mean, I'm happy to know she had a late period winner there. That's good because I will admit, I looked through her filmography in the, basically the last 15 years, and it was sort of like, it was like, boy, this was like the sort of red box shuffle here because it was these movies I've never heard of. And like I mentioned, it's like, like I mentioned, like she's co-starring with Dax Shepard in a movie. And I'm just like, that Diane Keaton should not be. I'm sorry. I don't mean to keep picking on Dax Shepard. Kristen
No,
Bell seems to like him. But I'm just like, Diane Keaton deserves better than this. So to hear her that she's in a movie with Candice Bergen and Jane Fonda and Mary Steenburgen, all of whom are great, that's good, right? I'm happy to hear that. But you mentioned about what following, watching her and doing something that once a woman reaches certain age, she's able to find something that excites her, something that, she's really engaged with. That makes me want to go back a little bit into the 80s and talk about this documentary I mentioned that she directed
Heaven.
called Heaven.
Tell me about
Now,
it.
this, when I was working at a video store in the 90s, we had this. We had Heaven. And if I recall correctly, I think it was out of print. So we had like the only VHS copy. And I
Oh,
was like,
cool.
and I remembered thinking, first of all, the premise is interesting because it's a documentary interviewing people about what they think happens after you die, right? And it interviews some people who have had after death, afterlife experiences and have come back. And I remember thinking, boy, that's an interesting premise. And directed by Diane Keaton. That seems kind of random. And I remembered I took it home and I thoroughly enjoyed it because it's you feel that she is fully engaged with the subject and it is not a vanity piece because obviously a lot of actors, once they get the power to direct, it can become like a vanity project. And it's like this is what she does with that card is a documentary about life after death. That's interesting. That's certainly uncommercial. And I feel like the film's gotten rediscovered over the years. I think it was even on the Criterion Channel at one point. And It's a terrific little movie. I don't even mean to say little as sort of a pejorative, but
No, I know what you mean.
it's a great little thread of an idea that she follows with a lot of humor and a lot of wit. And I was like, this is Diane Keaton director. Like, that's all, this is fantastic. I wish she had done more than just a couple of movies as director.
Dang, I would have loved to seen that too. And I remember reading that she was like religious growing up, and then I think as she got older, she identified more closely with being agnostic. But I think it's in line with her personal curiosity to make something like this. That's wild. And I too wish she'd explored that directorial through line a little bit more.
Yeah, I always appreciate when I know that getting the chance to direct something is you're really cashing in a lot of chits at that point to get to do it, and to do something as thoroughly uncommercial as that says a lot, as opposed to just sort of putting yourself, not that if you star in your own movie that means it's inherently bad, but just it's not the formula you would expect. Right, you could imagine. All right, she's finally going to direct. She's gonna star as this and direct herself. No. She's doing this documentary about life after death. Like, huh? Interesting. Okay. And I have to think that subject might have been something that was just fascinating to her, because another movie that she directed, which is less successful, called Hanging Up, where she plays a part of three sisters with Meg Ryan and Lisa Kudrow, and they are all the daughters of an aging Walter Matthau. And that is actually Walter Matthau's final film. If we ever get to do Walter Matthau on Fade Out, that'll be the last film we talk about, is Hanging Up. But she directs that, and it was marketed, at least I remember when it came out, and then it was marketed when it came to home video, as like a wacky comedy about, oh, these three sisters and dealing with their irascible dad, played by Walter Matthau. And it's not that. It's actually much more of a drama about dealing with a parent who is in their final stages of life. And I have to think that's just clearly something that Diane Keaton is interested in as subject matter.
Yeah, 100%. And I think it's that curiosity, that intellectualism. I shouldn't say intellectualism, that sounded insane. I think it's that like chasing what is interesting to you that gives you a decades spanning career and that level of like authenticity. And I think that answers the question of, well, how do you become an icon versus a familiar face? And I think it is having the thought, this authentic, why am I literally stumbling over my words? Having the authentic curiosity, and that's the through line.
So before we get to Summer Camp, which again, I mean, it's her last film, but it's I don't think I bet you agree with me that when it came word that she had passed away, it was genuinely shocking because she seemed so vital, right? You'd seen her in interview. I mean, she was in her 70s, not that that is tremendously old, but it's not super young either. But she seemed, very vital, and all of a sudden it was like Diane Keaton, like what? Diane Keaton passed away. So she, I don't think she probably intended Summer Camp to be her last film. Before we jump to Summer Camp, is there any other films of hers you want to touch on before we do get to the last one?
I would say, when I say honorable mention here, I'm not saying like these films stink. I just mean these weren't top of mind. Honorable mention, I think, goes to And So It Goes, which was wonderful
Oh,
with
was it?
Michael
Okay.
Douglas.
Now, which one
Yeah.
was that? Which one was
That's
that?
Michael Douglas. And
Okay.
that's, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago. And
Okay.
it's lovely. It's nice. And then, oh, and I want to say, let me double check so that I'm not an idiot. I want to say Rob Reiner directed that, and he was in it too.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, and
Yeah.
yeah, directed by Rob Reiner. Look at
And
that.
he is
Okay.
just, God rest his soul. He was so funny and just gregarious and brilliant. So that was great. And then I think Baby Boom was great. I did really
Yeah.
like that. And then I think her latest film that I thought had, not latest, I mean, maybe second or third to the latest that I thought had a lot of charm was Mac and Rita.
Really?
Yeah, I mean,
That's a
when
body switching comedy, isn't it?
I know, and there's pieces of it, you know, suspension of disbelief, blah, 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 you know. But I think what I like is just the premise in general, like that this 30-year-old switches bodies and they learn something. I'm a cornball.
Okay.
So I thought that was kind of cute and kind of, you know, whimsical and charming. But yeah, I think that's it. That's all that's on my list.
Okay. I'm genuinely shocked that Mac and Rita was one of
What?
the ones. Just because I read Diane Keaton in a body switching comedy, I'm like, oh, come on. Like,
I
what are
think
we
there were
doing?
portions of it where I was like, oh, but then there were portions of it where I was like, hey. And if I'm not
Okay.
mistaken, I think I saw it on an airplane or something, but maybe not. Don't fact check
Okay.
me on it. But wherever I was sitting there and I was like, hey, why not? You know, as
Okay.
the philosopher Hillary Duff said, why not? And then I turned it on and I was like, this is pretty charming. But yeah, there are definitely sections of it where I'm like, oh, Diane.
Okay. Yeah, all right. Maybe a trend set. Just it was just the sentence of body switching comedy. I was like, oh no. But okay, I'll take your word for it. I will take your
Oh
word for
yeah.
it. I really will. So okay. So all right. So her final film is called Summer Camp. It was released on May 31st, 2024. It stars Diane Keaton. The plot, very brief plot, is three childhood friends, Nora, Jenny, and Mary, spent their summer vacations together for years, but have recently grown apart. So when the chance to reunite at the summer camp where they all met presents itself, they take that chance. Diane Keaton plays Nora, Kathy Bates plays Jenny, Alfre Woodard plays Mary, and then you've also got Eugene Levy as one of the romantic interests, Dennis Haysbert. Beverly D'Angelo was kind of the mean girl that lived at the camp, and then Josh Peck, who is works at the camp, who's a guy named Jimmy. It was directed and written by Castiel Landon, who has a couple of films to her credit: Fear of Rain, After We Fell. I will admit, all the titles that she's credited as directing, I've not heard of any of these films. I've not seen them.
Sure.
So I'll go first because I don't want to put you on the spot. I found Summer Camp to be pretty thin. I just didn't really buy the chemistry of the three of them. I didn't buy them really as friends. I didn't find it particularly funny. I actually thought the best scene in the whole movie was Josh Peck. There's a scene where Kathy Bates insults him and it just lands on his face and he has to kind of react. And I was like, wow, why does in a movie with Diane Keaton and Alfre Woodard, why does Josh Peck get sort of like the best scene in this movie? And I just came away with it kind of like, all right. This was never the kind of movie she probably thought she was going to end her career on. She probably had a dozen more movies in her because, again, she's there. She's vital. She's funny. She's present. And I do find it a shame that this is the one that she wrapped up in. I never want to be too mean about it,
No, sure.
but I did find it just kind of was like, oh, all right. I don't know. What were your thoughts on it?
I have Mac and Rita on my list for a reason, just because I was like, I knew I'd watched Mac and Rita and I thought, oh, okay, you know, this is pretty charming. I knew going into summer camp, something told me telepathically that I would like Mac and Rita better, and I
Okay.
did.
Okay.
Which is weird because Dennis Haysbert, who, you know, waiting to exhale, are you in good hands? Dennis Haysbert, Alfre Woodard, Kathy Bates, Diane. I mean, if you put all that in a blender, it would probably be the kind of margarita I would want to inject in my
An
veins.
amazing cast. An amazing
Yeah.
cast. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think I was a little bit surprised. Do I say surprised? I think I, with all of those variables, I was like, oh, you know, that's such a Disney princess. I sound like Snow White trying to manipulate a bird to come over to me without saying too much. Tweet. Yeah, I would have to agree with you to an extent for sure. And I don't want to be negative either. But I watched it and I went, oh, you know, you've got all the ingredients, and I'm not sure why I'm not enjoying the taste too much. And I agree with you. It's like she probably had 12 more in her. She had so much quality. So it's very weird to like come to a screeching halt at
Yes,
summer.
that's a great way of putting it. Her career kind of comes to a screeching halt, as opposed to, right, where at no point are you like, boy, she's running on fumes and she's just not retiring. No, it's like she's still got it. She still got it. She just needs better material. Now, I will say, you mentioned this Mac and Rita. I noticed that the Mac and Rita movie is directed
Same
and written.
people.
Directed, written by a woman. This movie's directed and written, like, she's giving women chances to direct legendary people who probably wouldn't get that opportunity. So more power to it. That had to be a conscious choice as well.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I love the way you earlier kind of gave that line of demarcation, which again, I had not consciously thought of, but it's so true. And I think that's what gave her gas and staying power. Again, not to say, every man with a camera is evil. We should run from them. But that there is this kind of line where it starts to be women at the helm towards like the second half of her career. And I don't know how much of that was vis-a-vis osmosis and how much of that was curated and cultivated. That's so interesting.
It's what's your lived experience? And of course, what does, I mean, there's got to be some men that could effectively write 65-year-old women, 70-year-old women, but obviously a woman is going to be more adept at that because they're going to have life experience and they don't really get to direct movies too much. And I can imagine if you're Diane Keaton, you're like, well, I've already done. I mean, you did that quote, I'm the woman in a world of men. She's already been in like two of the most male movies ever in history, and the Godfather movies. And I mean, we kind of skipped over the Godfather movies, but because what else is there to say about them? They're the Godfather movies. There is something to be said that in Godfather 2, you could argue that her one big scene, which is the whole, it was an abortion, all that
Oh
whole
my
scene,
gosh.
that is the other than the Fredo, you broke my heart thing. You could argue that scene is the most memorable scene in The Godfather Part Two in a movie that's 3.5 hours long. It's Diane Keaton's one scene that is still so absolutely resonant. And it's funny to this day. My wife and I will use that line where we will talk about something that is like we want it to stop, and we will always say, this thing must all end. We're always using that as a code for like, this has got to be wrapped up. And it's there that I mean, she basically has like two scenes in that movie, and one of them is so iconic. It's unbelievable.
And they have her say like this Sicilian
Oh,
thing.
this Sicilian thing must all. Oh my God.
Yeah, for sure.
I am half Italian, so I always am using that. I'm like, this Sicilian thing must all end. It says, but I mean, it really does say something about her skills. That in a movie full of guys shooting each other and being dudes, she pops the way she does in that movie, even though she is also a complete sucker for Michael Corleone's good word. I mean, my God, she keeps
I love
falling, you know,
the
we're going to be
way.
legitimate in 5 years. 7 years later, we're still not legitimate. And you're like, okay, well.
So annoyed. That really that's the quickest way to grind my gears. I was like, really?
Yeah, that's a great, yeah, just it may, I mean, again, there's a whole other podcast just devoted to the Godfather movies. And so I would imagine, right, if you're Diane Keaton and you are coming from a background, you've been in Hair and on stage, and then you get to do Play It Again, Sam, and then you do this Lovers and Other Strangers movie where you're kind of only have a couple scenes, and then you just boom, you explode to that level. Where now every film that you do is now partly at least a Diane Keaton film. That's, you're not probably prepared for that, right? Well, if that's not what your goal is to become a huge star, you just want to be an actor. And all of a sudden it's like, well, now every movie you do is loaded with portent because you're such a huge star. Like she does Looking for Mr. We didn't even talk about Looking for Mr. Goodbar, which was this very forward-thinking, transgressive movie about a woman who is openly searching for like sexual thrills because that is what she wants. That is, and the movie is not, I mean, the movie ends in a kind of a grim way, which sort of suggests the movie's punishing her for her behavior, but
I
nevertheless, which
know.
is not great, but nevertheless, she's the lead of that movie and she's taking charge of kind of her own. She's the quintessential like 1970s woman in that film, and that's her in the lead of that film.
I feel like, when you watch these interviews of her, I think there was a later interview where someone said, "What do you think of your legacy?" And she was like, "I don't." And I think she was like, So, and I mentioned this at top already, so I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I think she was so grateful for the opportunity to do what she liked. And I think, and this is all conjecture on my part, I think she was so grateful. She mentions in an interview, she's like, I was just so lucky, you know, there's just so much good fortune. And you know, so and so picked me. They cast me before they even cast Al Pacino. Isn't that crazy? And then we did a read, and they wanted hit, you know. And so I think she was just so, there was a lot of gratitude and a lot of like awe. And I think she took that with her throughout her career of just kind of like, well, I'm doing what I love and I'm having fun and I'm chasing my whimsy. And yes, I mean, I don't think, I'm not trying to infantilize her. I think she knew who she was, you know. You know who you are in the world of cinema. But just refusing to bring it with her to an extent. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, she seemed like a complete whole person with other interests and other, you know, like, and just seemed to regard the whole fame thing as all very silly, which is probably an incredibly great way to handle it, right? To keep
And it's
yourself kind
not
of
how I would
level.
handle it. If I got famous, I'd be like, where is my latte? Bring the cabana boy. No one look me in the eyes. Why are you talking to me? No, I'm just kidding. But I love the
There's
way.
people picking brown M&Ms out of Taylor Curry's
Period.
bowl
Like,
and
I
stuff.
don't eat the brown ones. Are we joking? No.
Good to know. Good to know that you have to keep yourself. Don't worry, but this podcast will not help you and achieve that fame at all. So,
Oh, I'm sure it will. Don't
no,
do
I
that.
just mean the show. This, believe me, that
The
we're
show is
like.
great.
Well,
I listened
I
to
appreciate that.
Elizabeth Taylor episode. No, the show was great.
I know, I'm just, well, anyway, thank you. So yeah, we look on this show. We always try to remain positive. I am not ever interested in picking on a movie that I think is wanting because it's hard to make a movie. I've never done it. It's hard to make a movie. I mean, you've made films, right?
And it's really hard, and nobody, unless it's a freaking tax write-off, nobody's like, hey, let's really do a bad job. And so when you crank out a dud, you know, it's just disappointing for so many reasons.
And so, like I said, I don't mean to be too mean to Summer Camp. It's not like it's
Oh
some
no,
offensive
you're, I don't
movie. It's just kind of eh. And when you load it with the legend of it's the last Diane Keaton film, you're expecting something and it just doesn't really deliver. And like I said, it would have been great had she gone on to do 10 more movies and be funny and be great Diane Keaton. It would have been great, but we didn't have that opportunity. So as we're wrapping up here, the exit question I have for you regarding Diane Keaton is, I initially asked you what was your favorite Diane Keaton scene, and I think maybe that's a little too front loaded. What's just a particularly great scene of hers that resonates with you? I mean, from any of her movies, just not the whole movie, not even the character, but just a particular scene where you are like, boy, she really brought it in this particular moment.
Oh my God, I don't know. We also, I didn't talk about because I said so, which I forgot to do and I
Oh,
wanted to.
okay. Let's talk about before. Yeah, let's get let's get let's end on a happier note. What's before, how which one is before I said so?
Because I said so, it's Diane, Mandy Moore, I think Graham. Oh my gosh. Gilmore Girls.
Oh, Lauren Graham.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lauren Graham. There's a scene with her, Diane Keaton's love interest, who's an older guy, and I'm pretty sure it's played by an actor who also needs to be in the bin.
Oh no.
I'm pretty sure he needs to be in the trash can, but it's the dad from Seventh Heaven. He's got to go.
Oh no, Stephen
you've got to go.
Collins.
He's
Oh
got to go.
no.
We You need to report to the can
Oh
immediately.
no. Okay. Probably his last film, I'm betting, but okay.
But the scene itself is really memorable. She's talking about sexuality, and she says, she's talking about her marriage. I think it's a scene between she and her daughter, actually. That's what makes it powerful. She's talking to her daughter about her marriage, and she's talking about sexuality, and the daughter's like, Mom, you know, you don't like sex or something like that. It's just really intimate, like weird scene. And Diane has lost her voice. The character's lost her voice, so she has to write down. And so she writes down on this piece of paper, your dad would say, I don't have all day. And it's just so sad. And she talks about how he like abused her and stuff like that. This movie itself, you know, no, I don't think it won an Oscar. I think it really is just like a rom-com feel-good movie. But you get to see this character who's making bad decisions. The premise is like, my daughter won't get married or something, so I'm gonna make her a dating site and like force her, like very Machiavellian, like force her to meet this guy. And then along the way, she meets another guy who she actually really likes. And then she finds out that the dream guy is cultivated by me. And then we get in a big fight. But it's kind of along the way, you see why she's being so overbearing, that she's trying so hard to make sure she doesn't live what she had to live. And she's trying to find the perfect partner for her because no one curated her life. So there's like an answer to her being overbearing. Kind of back to the Thanos piece, the person making antagonistic choices believes that they're right. And then that scene is so tender. And it's this kind of femme-centric mother-daughter moment where you get to understand more about why this character is the way they are, why this character is the way they are. And then a few scenes later, you drop in the seventh heaven dad who the actor needs to go into the bin. The character's amazing. And like that becomes Diane's love interest. So I like it because it's like I'm a mom in this film, but I'm also a human being. I'm trying to cultivate my daughter's happy ending, and then I end up having a happy ending of my own. I end up finding romance and like my experiences, my romantic and sexual experiences from, my 20s and 30s and 40s, whatever. They are, I'm not shackled to that. And now, even in this late age, I'm experiencing pleasure and bliss, and I'm giving my daughter something. And so she's playing moms who like have their own business. And when I say business, I mean like when we give actors business and we give actors stuff to do. She's a mom character who has her own life. And I think at a certain point in her career, writers and directors became wise to kind of like, let's give this character dimensionality. I think that was super inarticulate. I feel like I didn't make.
No. You've actually sold me on it. I have to say, you've not sold me on Mac and Rita, but you've sold me on. I gen like you know. I mean, like once I'm moving on to the next get the next episode of the show, I'm now watching those films, and so a lot of times I don't go back and go and see other films of a subject I've already covered because I'm like, well, I'm kind of moved on to the next thing. But once in a while, I will. So just you describing that scene makes me want to see that one. So I will give that, I will hunt that one down. That one
I
I
think
will.
Gabriel Mott is in it. It's super cheesy, but it's like, it's feel good. It's really nice.
Okay. Yeah. No, just your description of that scene makes me want to see it. So I will absolutely watch that at some point, and I will report back to you about what I thought of it. Absolutely.
I
So
love that. And I'll be watching Warren Beatty embarrass himself.
there, oh God almighty. I bear no responsibility for you wasting 2 hours of your precious life watching Town and Country. I do, Taylor, I cannot, please. for the love of Pete. Okay, so but my answer to that, my favorite scene I have, and it might be my single favorite Diane Keaton scene in any movie, aside from this Sicilian thing, Masolin, is in Shoot the Moon, which I've already gone on and on about. But there's a scene in Shoot the Moon where, again, the movie is more about Albert Finney and his volcanic temper and his da 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 all this stuff. But there's a scene where the camera just follows Diane Keaton as she's by herself and she's in a tub and she's singing to herself. She's singing the Beatles' Blackbird. And she is just wrecked with sorrow that her marriage has fallen apart. And she's almost like self-soothing, singing this song to herself. And it is so unforced and so unmannered in every way that it feels so, and it feels so real that I find it's almost uncomfortable to watch because you feel like you are spying on a private moment, even though it's course it's a movie, it's filmed, but it almost feels so real that it's, I feel like I'm invading this person's privacy by watching it. And it's that good. And it's not, it's just her singing Blackbird. It's not like the dialogue that's been written for her is particularly, there's no dialogue. It's her singing a song that I know, but it's just her sitting in this tub, singing the song to herself. And the first time I saw the movie, it like blew me back. I was like, holy, how did she do that? Oh my God. So that would be my answer for my favorite
I
scene with
love
Diane
it.
Keaton.
Oh, I
Just
love it.
great stuff. Great stuff. So, well, Taylor, thank you so much for doing this. As I mentioned, when I saw you on stage after like 3 minutes of your presentation, I was like, I gotta have this person on the show. And I know sometimes it's just some rando person coming up to you and being like, be on my podcast. That could not go over super well, but luckily you were happy to do it. And so I really thank you for coming on and talking Diane Keaton with me. This was great.
It was so fun. Thank you for having me. And yeah, I loved this. It was awesome.
Why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Yeah, so you can find me, oh Lord, Curb Your Enthusiasm. You can find me and my four followers on Instagram. I think I'm at Ray of Sunshine, so RAYE 0F Sunshine, because I'm quirky like that. And then you can find my production company's website, where abundantlifeproductionco.com.
Okay, great stuff. So, well, again, thank you so much for coming on, and thank you for, selecting Diane Keaton, because I got to watch a bunch of Diane Keaton movies I hadn't seen.
Yeah,
That's always
I
great stuff. So, and I like said I Scout's Honor, I will absolutely hunt down because I said so, just because
love
I want to
it.
see that scene that you're talking about.
Yeah.
So
I think I'm probably going to go watch that instead of Warren Beatty.
I think that's a good idea. So anyway, thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes of this show on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can find the show on any podcatcher of your choice, and you can find the show over on Blue Sky at Fade Out Pod. And then finally, if you want to support the Fire & Water Podcast Network, please go to patreon.com/FWPodcasts, and there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big thanks to Monique D, Donald McWaters, Mark Balbus, plus David Gutierrez, Gord Tolton, Al the Comics Guy, and Mike Atchison for their support of Fade Out and the Fire & Water Network in general. So thank you all so much for listening. We'll be back with another episode next month, but we've reached the end of this particular script. So for now, it's time to fade out.
Did you like the awards?
I enjoyed it enormously.
Any surprises? Any disappointments?
No, none at all, actually. No, I enjoyed the whole thing. I particularly enjoyed Steven Spielberg, actually.
I missed that part.
You did? You were watching the other part?
Basketball.
Yeah.
He received
the Irving Thalberg,
Thalberg
yes.
Award
For lifetime
lifetime
achievement.
achievement.
This is something you and I will miss out on, I think. Yeah.
Probably so, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like.
But that was the. But no, you,
yeah.
But
Me
see,
on the other hand.
But you have one for your work, so that wouldn't.
For my work, my acting work, you mean? Yes, oh yes.
Yeah. And so you really, I mean, it would be nice to be honored for your lifetime.
I would love to be honored for my lifetime achievement, yes.
All right,
this is pathetic, right?
No, what do you mean it's pathetic?
I mean, it's pathetic, let's
Oh,
face
no,
it.
No, it's not pathetic.
I feel good, though, I really do.
Why, how did that happen exactly? Well, you look great.
Oh, shut up.